Okay, this is Cameron McEwen and Bob Dobbs once again, and this is the 50th episode being recorded on June 9th, 2022. And we're looking at the bottom of page 98, where the blue text, which is my oral ramblings, are presented, what we want to look at. So right above that, Playboy excerpt, Playboy magazine, how, let's see, how would you program the planet or something like that. What's the guy say? So McLuhan says, all these convulsive changes, as I've already noted, carry with them attended pain, violence, and war, the normal stigmata of the identity quest. But the new society is springing so quickly from the ashes of the old that I believe it will be possible to avoid the transitional anarchy many predict. Automation and cybernation can play an essential role in smoothing the transition to the new society. So the interviewer says, how? Kuhn says, the computer can be used to direct a network of global thermostats to pattern life in ways that will optimize human awareness. Already it's technologically feasible to employ the computer to program societies in beneficial ways. Playboy says, how do you program an entire society, beneficially or otherwise? And before Marshall gives his answer, I say this, which is a more colloquial way, less formal way of addressing what Playboy is asking. I say this is a time when people are thinking they're free. This is the late 60s. They aren't interested in being programmed. That's like fascism. Eric Norden, the interviewer, can't believe what McLuhan's saying. McLuhan's pushing this programming. McLuhan's very detached when he's saying it. He proclaimed it, and people read it and exclaimed, quote, there's a cold tone to McLuhan that's frightening. This guy is so nuts. He's trying to turn Orwell into an art form as if it's acceptable, unquote. Not that anybody ever actually said that, but I do know that some reviewer thought that McLuhan's tone was very cold. And I think that essay's in Hot and Cool. And so there's my made-up statement of some sophisticate. And then I say, and McLuhan knew that he was having that effect, that people would be frightened. It was the level of a satire, but he was pointing out really what was happening. The economy was programmed by the banks at that point. People didn't have any updated thinking mechanism for it. They didn't have any models for the coming virtual economy, virtual in quotes. Mm-hmm. So then McLuhan asked,
let me just note there, Bob, that I agree with what you say there. I think that all makes good sense. But McLuhan had actually been talking about this. This is 1968 when he's talking to the interviewer.
Yeah.
He'd been already talking about this for something like 20 years and had no success whatsoever trying to explain to people what he was talking about.
Is there any particular essay that comes to mind where somebody could look that up as a sample of him talking about it in the 50s, say?
Well, usually it comes out as sort of a sidebar in his essays. In almost every one of them, he talks about how there were revolutions in Greece around 400 BC, and the Gutenberg Galaxy Revolution starting sometime around 1500. And he always points out that those things happened relatively slowly. And so now here we are undergoing a revolution that's much, much faster and much, much more dangerous because of the bomb. And so now we there's a kind of emergency response that's necessary to get a handle on what's happening to us. So in all of his essays, I would say that this is a ever-present undercurrent, but in something like Prospect, let's say, 1962, you can see that McLuhan is actually frightened by what's going on and how little we know about it.
I wonder if that's be done, that interview's before the October missile crisis or after. You haven't a clue?
I don't. That would be an interesting question, but I assume that it's before.
Yeah. I think you would have mentioned it if it had happened.
Yeah. And
do you have a quote there? You have a quote and a sample handy?
From Prospect?
Yeah.
No, I've
quoted it. Let's see if I can come up with it. Just a second. So we'll put in Prospect. Yeah, I have it. So got to find where it is. So it's in my index at the back, or quotes. So what's a word in that thing?
Well, I've got, nightmare is one.
Okay.
Heightened is another, a very heightened kind of existence, a sort of nightmare.
Right. Let's see.
Right.
What comes up
he talks there. About the condition of man is what you dread. You no longer dread that animal, that famine, and so on, but this condition. Right. So he's talking about a danger that's global, but it's global inside as well as outside.
Yeah. Okay, so PR, how did I do this? I'm just going through my Fatty Communion book. See, I would have just
should
taken...
You want me to read the quote that I have in the blog?
No, I want to see if I can find what I picked. Okay, so you read your quote, and let's see if it's familiar.
Okay, so he says, you couldn't bear a fully conscious existence under the frenetic conditions that he's exposed to. You could not register these terrible shocks directly and survive. He'd go mad. I think that all human technology and invention has occurred under this kind of anxious pressure. You don't outer anything until you're under some dire pressure and fear. But fear is no longer the problem. Anxiety is the problem. Fear is specific. Anxiety is total. You don't know how precisely, you don't know now precisely what you're dreading. Rather, it's a pervasive state. The condition of man is what you dread. You no longer dread that animal, that famine, and so on, but this condition. Anxiety means utmost alertness, utmost watchfulness, involvement, and therefore, of course, a very heightened kind of existence, a sort of nightmare.
Wow. I don't remember any of that. I certainly don't have that excerpt. So I'm trying to see what I did do. But so far, I'm not coming across it. Since I don't have any words, I don't have heightened. That doesn't bring anything up. I can only go with my letter code, PR.
Uh-huh.
That's not coming up. There's too many PRs. So.
What about anxiety?
Okay, try that, anxiety. I think it was something about art. Programming the environment or something, maybe. What is said about art? See anything?
No, I'm going to another part of the blog to see if I've got other stuff.
What's a page number? You have a page number for it in Prospect?
One second, I have to go back here. No, I didn't note the page. I've stopped doing page references in the blog because I want to force people to use the digital environment to see what's out there. It's incredible to me how paper-bound McLuhan Research is. It's nuts.
Okay. Well, it's not working. Give me another art, something like art. What does he say uniquely about art? Does he say constructivist in there? Doesn't he talk about the 1910s, a little art history?
Maybe. I'm trying to find the complete article at the moment. It was 1962. Can you search for Prospect 1962?
Yeah, I have that in my index at the back. See, I have a quote in my book and then a code, so the code is explained, but I don't have the title by the quote. I just have a code, like PR. So you look in the index and you see PR and see what it refers to. So,
But it doesn't give you a page number or something when you go to the index?
No. The page number is by the quote. So I can usually find, I know the quote so well, I'll just take a word and it'll take me to the quote. The sources are at the end of the book and they are
well,
not.
Well, he certainly talked about art because the article appeared in Art Magazine, right? I think it's Canada Art or something like that.
Right. See, I thought there was something special in that article. So let's.
Whole article is special. It's a very strange submission, I would say.
Yeah, but the thing is, I usually would find a quote, and I would have sections like a whole bunch of quotes on art.
Uh-huh.
So they're not in order. So I have to keep scanning till I find it. But you're looking at the article. Does he talk about camp or is that too early?
I'm trying to get to the article right now, but I'm not there. He certainly did talk about camp and Susan Sontag, but whether he does so in that article, I cannot tell you yet.
Okay, so I'll keep going along here. There's a lot of quotes from Cliché to Archetype.
Yeah, that was written in the 60s, but it appeared after the Playboy interview.
In Prospect? No, Prospect was 62. I have the actual.
No, I was talking about Cliché and Archetype.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just there's just a lot of good quotes I have. I can find my code CA easily for that. I hope people find this interesting, working our way through the process of indexing here to archivists.
Yeah.
How we work.
You gave me that book when we met in New York in 59, I guess it was. Maybe
98. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So what could be a word, an idea that would be in that article? Very important article, people. See if you can find it. He does speak differently than he was saying in 62 in most interviews. He moved
to an important article for his biography, for sure.
Yeah.
And it reflected, I think it reflected his terrible health at the time.
Mm. Yeah, maybe he wanted to get something said that he normally wouldn't revealed. So the only thing to do is to scan down through the McLuhan section. So let's go up here. You got the LaRouche section. And then you go to the McLuhan section. a lot of great quotes by LaRouche for efficient causality. You can keep talking while I'm looking.
All right.
Things that occur to you.
I'm just pulling up the article now, so I should be able to give you a bunch of...
So the programming aspect, what do you think is in that article that you brought?
Well, no, you were saying, you were talking about, I pointed out that the problems that you were mentioning in your pamphlet, McLuhan had been talking about for 20 years. So there was the interview represented one more attempt by McLuhan to communicate the problems that he saw going on and the only sort of solution that he saw to them. And already in the, let's say in the 1947 or so period, he already had a pretty good idea of what he had to do. And the Playboy interview just represents one more attack on that same salient.
Okay, I think I found it.
Oh. Okay, good.
Begins
by talking about television.
Yeah, he says new languages. It just passed over just a second. There it is. Page 366. That sound correct? Would it be that high of a number?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the first page of the article is 363.
Yeah, there it is. Okay, so put in 366. Well, this is the famous quote I'm always quoting. I always thought he said that in 65. So here's the important part for me. So he says, these new forms, television and radio, are new languages. They're huge extensions of ourselves, which enable us to participate in one another's lives, much as language does. But these forms lay down their own ground rules. The modes of participation are already built into the technology. There are real, rigid art rules for each form. I like that, rigid art rules. So he's talking about media's art forms there. The fact that we have many media now enables us to leap across the barriers from one form or one set of rules to another. And I think it is this multiplicity of media that is now enabling man to free himself from media for the first time in history. He has been... See, so the medium is a massage is not necessarily happening anymore, other than this new weird detachment is a product of the global theater, which is like an invisible environment, invisible media, the collection of it. I call it, global tactility. So,
right. But it's not right to say that the massage is not happening anymore. It's the massage is always happening. It's just a question of... how it is happening, and what our consciousness is of it.
Right. Now, this is a key point. The massage at this point in the middle 60s makes people feel that they're not being controlled by the environment. That's the effect of the massage. See? So all those movements celebrating their freedom, chemical body freedom in the 60s, all came to naught by the 70s because the larger massage that they didn't recognize was coming in and would become the digital Android meme and then a tech body. See, people thought they'd come to some kind of end point of Orwellian control of themselves and were feeling free of it. Even the kids felt that way with the Summer of Love, you know?
Yeah, especially the kids, I would say.
Yeah, they were picking up the instinct. So he says, and I think it is this multiplicity of media that is now enabling man to free himself from media for the first time in history. He has been the victim, the servo mechanism of his technologies, his media, from the beginning of time. But now, because of the sheer multiplicity of them, he is beginning to awaken, because he can't live with them all. So McLuhan has to say, because he's using words, that there's some kind of independence of media happening, but he has to drop the other half of the idea. Well, you're being conditioned to think that you're free from these media because there's so many of them. You think almost indifference or void you're put into is freedom. But he has to say one half the idea and then say the other half later. Can't say both at the same time. It looks too confusing to him just trying to get some basics across. You get that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's how you read McLuhan, what we're just saying here. So this quote was well worth going into because it is one of my favorite quotes. Nobody knows he said it. A rare person, maybe guy who writes a book on McLuhan might come across it. But it's a very unique statement because everybody's going around, well, we're victims of the media, we're victims of TV, and they're still living in the 50s. They don't see the mixture of media environments that the satellite has brought in or is the proscenium arch, covering this interplay of TV, computers, and radio, and bulldozers, and everything. It's a tactile world of objects, environments, not the tactile, raw thing that electricity is, an extension of our tactile central nervous system. It's now, you have an image of your central nervous system, okay, but to go, you have to have a new image of the global theater. That's what's tactile. I maintain nobody gets that point until
maybe
later.
I don't get it either. What I think that tactility is the essence of the electric environment.
Yes, it's the essence of electricity, and then people learn that electricity is the extension of the central nervous system. But the interplay of environments, whole environments, the TV landscape, the radio landscape, the magazine, all the different industrial media environments are now floating in a satellite proscenium arch. And so you're tuning the sky. And the sky is made up of these clouds, which are different environments. So the interplay of the leadership or the corporate emperors of these different environments are in a tactile interplay, so that the Orwellian idea of a committee running everything is not adequate. There is a committee behind the scenes, at least the intelligence agencies are trying to coordinate something, but they're inside a very chaotic interplay that has a kind of symmetry to it. There is an ecology going on in the tactile effect of all the environments intermingling in the global theater. But humans can't see that, so they think chaotically in response. So McLuhan, to the degree he wrote a poetic vision, like a romantic poet or a symbolist or a Blake, was the poetry of the global theater, the interplay and balancing of eye, ear, and tactility and kinetic and smell and all the senses and through their extended environments is a vision. Now, he knows a vision is not enough. You have to get into applying Joyce. You have to apply media ecology, which is the Playboy statement, you modulate the environments, which you don't take literally, but I do. At least he presents that for someone to think about, that there is a solution if people wanted to get coordinated clairvoyantly and come up with a solution. Well, McLuhan came up with it. Global programming is more important than financial programming through the banks and the central banks and the programming that was Keynesian economics. So go ahead.
Well, when you say that you take it literally, how can you not deposit yourself into the Gutenberg galaxy, which is the attempt to base human identity and society on the letter, the literal?
Well, I don't know if it's Gutenbergian to say, okay, there's too much radio in Venezuela, we're going to turn the radio off and bring in newspapers for a month to cool off or hot up, whatever term he's going to use about that situation for that culture. The actually doing that, in other words, I think that when he said, I'm the center for culture and technology, he's the center of this new knowledge and the new way to manage the economy, not the way the bankers do it, because they're just propping up Gutenberg identity. with private property and individual ownership and wealth and people becoming wealthy. That's all Gutenbergian. He says that's not real wealth anymore. Real wealth is everybody engaging and participating in whatever electric media they have access to. It's way beyond property ownership or hardware ownership. So let's modulate that. If you could get people to see his vision, let's let me and my buddies see what happens if we turn these media environments off and on. Just stop them for a little while. And we might even have a way to do it orderly by looking at different society sensory thresholds and seeing what is making them heated or cooled down. So,
But look at how McLuhan by this time had for 20 years had been talking about what he calls arrest. So the aesthetic moment, he calls it.
Yes.
And
which was a Gutenberg moment. That's a Gutenberg art, the aesthetic moment, because in the electric age.
Well, it happens in Gutenbergian time, you could say.
Yeah.
But for McLuhan, what it indicates is that that moment is the labyrinth, he says. So especially people like Mallarmé understood that it was no longer a moment in the external landscape. It was a moment in the internal landscape.
Yeah.
So that moment had to be taken as a labyrinthine thread to get down to the internal basics of the personality landscape, the interior landscape. So when he's talking about stopping, he's not talking about stopping in the external landscape where you have your TV stations and your newspapers and all that sort of stuff. He's talking about getting into the interior landscape where talk about television, the press, radio are literal transcriptions of the outer landscape that can perform as a way of getting a grasp on the internal one. And that will that transformation from the external to the internal involves metamorphosis, it involves deliteralization. So if you think for a moment about,
stop there. Do you mean interior, the collective interiority, which has been extended?
Yeah, so When the interior landscape becomes exposed, then the problem of the dialectic between the individual and society also becomes exposed. And that dialectic is just another word for language. So McLuhan is constantly saying that we need new languages to come to grips with this moment that we're in.
Yes, and the moment is a time of incredible wealth and experience, whole new experiences. So,
yeah, and danger.
Oh, yeah, but see, he's saying, I'm going to tell you what's happening. And if anybody could understand it and had some influence, maybe they'd let him have a role at the United Nations. But he couldn't rely on them getting his poetic vision, because when you talk about the aesthetic moment, that's what understanding media is. It's a presenting of the Marconi moment, the global theater. Okay, so let's say nobody gets that. There's still the ongoing panic and danger of these environments creating unforeseen effects. And on that level, he says, look, let me handle this emergency by telling you you're going to have to turn off radio for a couple of weeks, even though it's painful. Are you going to have to turn off TV? That's all he was applying on the practical level, and trying to. And all he could get were a couple of small towns to experiment it, do it. And usually, it was such a upset in the town's life that they quickly got back on and continued on the path to oblivion by keeping the media going. So he had a practical, efficient causality. A solution, not that anybody's ever going to believe it, but it was on the record. And so I include that. I went on the radio in the, 84, saying this is what we need to do. Nobody knew what I was talking about. They didn't know McLuhan had said it unless I pointed out. But I presented myself as a political answer to all the chaos that was going on using McLuhan. So I dared to apply that quote literally to do what he said to
right.
do. Now,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I would just add that that's just before the digital implosion. You couldn't do that by 1980. You know what I mean? It was a one-time mm-hmm. solution for 1968, which could have been implemented if there were wiser people in charge, but there
right.
weren't. And there never is in charge wiser people. So that has him, as I said in my speech about this at Fordham in March 98, he fell back on Menippean satire. His books and actions are stressing the absurdity. But it was not his conclusion about life that life was absurd. He's just that the reality cannot understand the new prophet, and so the prophet has to witness absurdity all around him in people's
right.
reactions. So, yeah, pick up what you were going to say.
All right, so I want to go back to the small-town experiment,
yeah.
turning off TV for a while, for example. You call it a solution. But what kind of solution? I don't think there was any solution going on. It wasn't as if the people in the small town, if they turned off their television and it remained off, it wouldn't be some sort of condition of paradise in that town. It wouldn't be something where there was no crime anymore. It wouldn't be something where people weren't anxious. Really,
okay, now let me respond to that. I certainly don't mean that. What would happen is that tragedies of all levels would happen. And then people, if McLuhan was there to speak to them, have a town meeting halfway through the week and everybody's in a wreck, and then he could say, you see how addicted you are to this thing? Do you see right. how you need it? And it's not healthy to need a fucking toy like this. But it's not
correct.
A toy. It's all involving. It's a whole new reality. You know, he would take the disservices, and that would be a way towards a solution. Point out that they're sick and they didn't know it. That's why you turn
correct.
It off.
That's all correct. So what you're saying is that the manipulation of media to show disservices points to something that needs to become conscious if people are to become healthy again.
Yeah.
And that's exactly right. So that means that the when people become aware of their dependence on multiple media, it's something that they can research for the first time.
Yeah.
So they don't suddenly awaken into a whole new awareness and a whole new research environment. What they do is they slowly begin to understand that there's parts of a human reality, the human condition, that they have sort of let slide in the ecstasy, you could say, following the Gutenberg galaxy, an ecstasy that had an underside of panic. So what McLuhan's doing in that small-town experiment is he's trying to show, number one, that media are real things with real effects, and you're sitting in this maelstrom of these effects, and you don't even know it. So in a world where the greatest thing in the environment is the atomic bomb or the nuclear bomb, not to be aware of these huge effects is very, very dangerous. And what we need to do is focus on what these media are and what their effects are.
Right. So I said that McLuhan, proposing this project for small towns or whatever level of society took it on, was the most important art form, way more important than theater, music, whatever other arts there are. They just give messages to people, Gutenberg information, messages. They're not made aware of the new surround, and I don't like using the word addiction, but it communicates, the addiction that's going on, so that the new drug not LSD or anything else, cocaine. It is the environments. And the only way to point it out, the only way to deal with it artistically, is to do what he suggested, have people go on media fasts. So that was the most important message for his time that one-upped all the wonderful messages of the Beatles or Broadway plays or Hair or whatever, the Esalen, whatever the Black Power. These were tiny and puny for chemical bodies and did not deal with the new situation. So I find it interesting that throughout culture, there's always someone who's very close to the perfect, quote, solution or answer about the issues. And I think that's what you celebrate, the great philosophers who seemed and call out the disease more accurately than other people. They never got a solution, you say, but McLuhan represents that tradition. He called it right. He had perfect pitch. Do you know what I mean? Among all the other people who had all their issues and concerns, from Rachel Carson and pollution, or Noam Chomsky and manufacturing consent, this lists off a million of them. They all were puny compared to the larger effect that Marshall saw.
That's right. And they, this, you use the term media fast.
Yeah.
And that's an excellent description of what McLuhan was advocating. But the media fast didn't mean you canceled your subscription to the Toronto Daily Star. You unplug your televisions. You don't listen to radio anymore.
Right.
That's not what a media fast is. What a media fast is the gap into which the person and individuals and society must enter in order to begin to understand what media are. As long as you're in some medium and it is dominating your thought, you cannot understand the media environment, which is a mixture of media. So the media fast is a methodological demand. It's the demand that a person or a group of persons, and ideally whole society, withdraw from media dominance in order to understand what media dominance is.
And so that's why it is so irrelevant and disgusting to Marshall to ask whether he liked TV or not. Was it more important
Correct.
Than print? And all those value judgments are totally irrelevant because
Correct.
You have a media fast to find out what is this thing? What does it do that's different from books or movies? You know,
Correct.
That's part of the goal of the fast is to understand a little closer what the structural components of the environment are. You definitely
Exactly.
don't make judgment calls on, oh, my God, we're losing literacy. You don't know. Mm-hmm. More and more people read books than ever, I think, over the last 50 mm-hmm. years because they have more leisure time to read and they live longer. But that doesn't accomplish anything really in media dynamics. There's a lot of people reading, you know, Julian Huxley and those guys in the 19th century that, you know, got the working class to go to evening classes and starting to become literate is a puny operation and what's necessary. So everybody kept asking whether Marshall was for books or not. What an irrelevant response.
Correct, correct. So just think for a moment about Darwin in the 19th
yeah.
century. What Darwin does is he says, look, everybody, are participating in an environment that nobody knew about before. It's the environment of evolution. And what this does is it, this consciousness of this environment that we exist in, that is a whole new research environment. And it's one that changes how people think and how people operate in the external environment. But it also raises questions about human identity and human society. So what McLuhan is, in order to see that, of course, what Darwin had to do is he had to say, look, folks, you have to withdraw from your current thinking and see yourself and the world in a different perspective.
Yeah, which evokes so different thoughts. You're going to have some new thoughts.
That's right. So McLuhan is suggesting something similar for the 20th century.
Yeah.
What he's saying is there is an environment, it's actually environments plural, but there is an environment in which you exist that you do not see. It's like a fish in water. And our problems cannot be solved except by withdrawing from this stuff. So when you talk about solution, I think what you mean, or what I take you to be to mean, is that the solution is the withdrawal that raises the question for the first time.
Yeah.
And if you mean solution in that sense, then we completely agree.
Yeah. Yeah. It's maybe a better word is tactic in a problem. A tactic would be to have a media fast. Or is that a strategy?
No, I think it's a tactic.
Yeah.
The strategy is enabling a new environment in which these questions can be collectively addressed in the same sense that our physical environment can be physically addressed now.
Right.
Right. It's what we need is the classroom without walls for the interior landscape.
Which is not interior inside the skull. You don't mean
no,
that.
Definitely not. No, of course not.
You could even call it outer space. McLuhan used to say that going into outer space was going into inner space.
Correct.
Because there's
absolutely
no visual
correct
boundaries. So
right,
if you, yeah, you would have to say interior landscape, and I've never gotten you to say this up to this point, but you're agreeing with what I'm saying, correcting it, or what you would add to the description of what you mean by interior landscape. It's a new water. It wouldn't be inside or outside of the body. It's somewhere else.
And it's not a spatial question.
No.
So McLuhan all the time says what we've done is we've gotten rid of the idea that space is the parameters of our problems. It's not. So
right.
When he talks all the time about consideration, and the sitter in consideration, it refers to the Latin word for star, sidereal.
Right.
So when something is considered, it's considered in terms that exceed our galaxy. Right. Our galaxy is only one environment amongst countless others, and that environment beyond our galaxy is a sidereal environment. So when McLuhan talks about outer space, what he's talking about is the environment that exceeds our galaxy and demands our thinking about the context of human beings beyond the stars. So
yeah,
that outer space, as you were just saying, that kind of outer space then rebounds into our inner space and calls that inner space, along with the outer space, into question. Who are we? What are we doing? What should we be doing? What's really at stake in human being? And
yes,
that's the global membrane and the global theater.
Right, the global main, global membrane. So how I was defining tactility as this interplay of the environments with the clouds mm-hmm. that inside the satellite frame, you're, and so I said it's somewhere else. So this extended tactility, I used to call it tactility squared or cubed,
yeah,
that's exactly what you mean by interior landscape, what I mean
yeah
by tactility. It's cubed. You know what I mean? So we've come to a match on your terms versus my terms, because to me, interior landscape is too acoustic, or you think of it as in the skull. But I got you to say, no, it's beyond the skull, and bringing in outer space is inner space, and that gets you beyond your bodies and beyond the planet as art form, again, the solar system as art form, and that's what you would call global tactility. and not the simple idea that electricity is tactile and comes from our central nervous system. That's very puny compared to what you're describing as the interior landscape, if you accept my interpretation of your interior landscape.
Yeah, I think so, but yeah. I wouldn't call the tactility of electricity puny. I would call it the dynamic that is exactly what we need to question. And the peculiarity of that is that you can't question the dynamic of tactility from the outside, because
right.
the dynamic of tactility is already operating in everything that we do. So yes. this kind of withdrawal that we're talking about is very, very difficult, and it causes anxiety in people. And the whole question of why wasn't McLuhan able to communicate, and then going all the way back to Plato and others, why weren't they able to communicate? That's McLuhan's numb, and he could see that people, for some very strange reason, cannot enter into this media fast. Causes them too much anxiety, causes them too much disorientation, and rather than do that, they self-amputate the consciousness of their need to do it.
So we know we did have that happen. COVID
That's
lockdowns.
Right.
COVID lockdowns was approximating a media fast. They still had the digital world to play in, but a lot of other bodily activities and TV landscape stuff, couch mm-hmm. potato stuff was amputated. And this really freaked people out. They really globally
yeah.
had a panic, to the point it even probably threw Fauci and the so-called managers of things, threw them off. And they didn't know what they were doing, and they panicked too, because they couldn't believe that way people, they didn't just become passive slaves. They were nervous wrecks and started doing all kinds of crazy stuff in their families, committing suicide, disrupting wherever they were, having fights all over the place. So we did have the global McLuhan fast with the COVID lockdown. It showed
right.
showed the what would happen on a global level. So, and it's interesting.
Now you could say he was predicting what was inevitable.
Yeah.
So if human beings do not come to terms with these questions, there will be a global fast in the guise of nuclear war that will turn people off from media, but may do so for good.
Yeah. Yeah. May shut everything down completely. So
that's right.
So I was so confident about the accuracy of what we're saying. So I went on the radio and said, I don't want to hear from any of you other people. You don't know what you're talking about. Listen to me. I will spell out, because I understand McLuhan, and he nailed it right. So I did that, you could say, as an art form, as an entertainment. But I was serious if people took it seriously. Nobody took it seriously. So I joined the great tradition of lost philosophers and carried on. But then things have turned around now. Now they're listening. But the interesting thing is I understood that everybody else was noise. And I don't call that fascism. I'm just saying, hey, buddy, take time. Do it fast. See what happens to you. And if you find it really uncomfortable, here's a guy. Read his books. He's explaining where it came from, how it happened, how it evolved, where you got to this state. I thought that was the best thing to tell people to engage, to study, in a world that was reluctant to study because they're having too much fun with all the different environments they were free to play in. Right?
Yeah.
A lot of distractions.
Sure. Yeah. So notice the parallel with Freud, Jung, and Adler, all of whom McLuhan studied fairly closely in the 30s and 40s. If people started going to psychotherapeutic sessions when their prosperous life, their life with rules about marriage and about business and about social conventions, yeah, all that stuff, when that broke down.
Yeah.
And so they had to go to some place where they would sort of clutch in the sense of a clutch in a car, they would clutch their lives and they would begin to go over what they didn't know, what that was unconscious but operating.
Yeah.
So in a way, what McLuhan is trying to do is the psychoanalysis of society, of world history. And that's why he liked Finnegan's Wake so much, because he saw a similar activity going on with Joyce.
Yeah, he had a phrase for it, corporate psychiatry.
Uh-huh.
That was his term about what he was doing as opposed to Jung and Freud or anybody else in the therapy world.
That's right.
Corporate psychiatry.
So he had McLuhan, even before he first went to college, was hyper-conscious of language through his mother.
Yeah.
Right? So he grew up in an environment where his mother's going around muttering all the time in different voices, and it dominated their house.
Yeah.
And so it did so in a kind of a negative way for everybody. But when McLuhan came to study English at the University of Manitoba, he had all of these voices echoing in his head.
Yeah.
And he continued to pursue the idea that there's a plurality of languages going on. And if we're going to achieve some sort of balance, some sort of understanding of our language environment, we have to understand that plurality. And he just continues along that line. And eventually, in 1958, he says the media is the message. So instead of talking about the different languages that have been involved in English literary history, which had been his shtick for decades, he now said, well, let's, instead of talking about that, let's talk about the media, because the media is something that everybody thinks that they're concerned with, and all they really need to do is say, what is it that we're concerned about with these media? And if they pursue that question, it will lead them inside and into some sort of revolution about thinking about themselves and thinking about society.
You said resolution?
Yeah.
Yeah, resolution, not revolution, resolution. That's what you said.
Well, I think I said revolution.
With a revolution. All right, so 2 points. You were just saying there. Okay, I want to go to the other point. He threw his life experience when he was young threw into question about what should be done in an educated environment, because he grew up in a madhouse, in a very subtle madhouse. The father was a passive, talkative, you know, storyteller, supposedly didn't do much otherwise, and his mother was going around like a maniac, mumbling the great classics, obsessed with them, memorizing them, planning on performing him, and he is in the middle of that, and that made him ready. That madness made him a little different in when he got into education, which would equal the madness, which was Cambridge.
That's right. And but what he brought to that madness that most people didn't have was the kind of equanimity that his father had.
Yeah.
So his father was somehow able to exist in this mad environment with a sense of humor and kind of feeling, well, you know, yeah, it's crazy, but that's sort of the way it is, and I can live with that. And McLuhan brought those two things from his parents that were
complimentary,
necessary. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so it's interesting how reality, whatever that is, something bigger than us maybe, that conditions people to be what they become. And so he, that's probably why he did so poorly in the grade school, grade six, and that he flunked grade six. You know, it was so calm and normal and non-mad, it just didn't, it couldn't activate him because he was used to a more intense environment, you know? So he was not prepared for the dull school level until he met one teacher, supposedly, that was sparked him. But the you see, he's quite, quote, megalomaniac in his years at Manitoba, he's writing for the student newspaper quite much like his later personality, saying here these guys, the leaders of society, they got that all wrong. These guys are erroneous over there. Remember, you've read some of those articles, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
He has quite a superiority complex going on, but that's a result of his environment, what he grew up in. So it throws in what is the value, what is the way to do education if you get different reactions, as McLuhan being an example of a totally different perverted environment, not your normal balanced situation, or is it due to just unique individuals? Mother was unique in doing what she did, and the father was unique, so they were a special family already.
Yes, I think so. But he then found himself in a special environment, right?
Yeah.
World wars, bombs, new inventions that the world had never seen before. So all of these things sort of came together for him. He's not unique in the sense of had things come together for other people. Yes, of course they had. And very great minds had grappled with all of these things in the past, or at least comparable things in the past. In order to grapple with them in new conditions, what you have to do is start again.
Yeah.
You have to retreat through a mental fasting to where the questions can first be raised. And McLuhan was one of those fairly exceptional people for whom that happened.
Yeah. So Bucky Fuller thought he had the answer. Freud thought he had the answer. Is it a quality of Gutenberg conditioning that it heightens the individual's thought processes and perspective to make them think that they can direct the whole culture? I think that's just it's an intellectual act, which would come in before the printing press and maybe in manuscript culture, but, you know, 2,000 years before, you had to be a mighty Caesar to take over, right? You had to be powerful physically, militarily.
Yeah.
So,
so it's important for you to clarify that when you're talking about somebody orchestrating the media environment, you're not talking about a new Caesar. You're not talking about some sort of fascist leader that's
right.
Going to do this.
Yeah, so it's the way presently Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum is trying to be, right?
Correct.
He pontificates the whole world about how it's going to go, and it's so inadequate, it's so erroneous that you can start to get suspicious. Okay, the real people behind the scenes are putting up the idiots so that they don't get found out, you know? Behind the scenes, there are behind the scenes. It's interesting how a hot word like, a word that is hot causes a lot of sight and sound and fury is the conspiracy. And I remember seeing Groney on TVO in Ontario talking on a panel, and he said, all businesses are conspiracies. That's how you do business. You get together, you scheme and plan about how you're going to market something. That's a conspiracy, he says, against the public.
Yeah.
So It's a word that actually is the most important word for our time, but it needs to be better explained and elaborated on all the potential angles to look at what a conspiracy is and how we are. So I think people are projecting a Gutenberg idea of conspiracy, and the actual conspirators aren't doing that. They're not concerned about media messages. That's what Jacques Ellul pointed out. Propaganda is not the messages, the literate content, the spoken content. It's the machines and their environments that you're living in. That's the propaganda.
Correct. And so it's a conspiracy in the sense that you're talking about is like a language that people are living in, and there's definite rules to the language, but people and don't know how they're shaped by them. So conspiracy is always going on. It's not as if we can ever exist aside from conspiracy, but we need to understand the conspiracies, plural, that are possible for human beings. And
right.
So for McLuhan, the whole idea of how would we ever have peace, P-E-A-C-E, how would we ever have peace is question that is both raised and in a certain sense answered by awareness of the plurality of media that somehow allow understanding. The possibility of understanding media means that there's a kind of language that we can implement to understand our surrounding languages. And that meta-language is the key to peace. And that's what understanding media is.
Yeah.
As a phrase.
Yeah, so that quote I read from Prospect, it begins with radio and TV as new languages. So you were talking about how he was involved with literate languages, and then he recognized in 58 there was larger languages afoot. And it required a new kind of Esperanto or Volapük or some kind of new form of expression, at least to mirror the new expression that was happening around us. Now, I think I had another point there.
And,
so,
and remember, in 1956... he and Carpenter published an essay called The New Language.
Right, right. Was that Thinking on Language? Was that another essay by Carpenter? Remember that pamphlet?
That's another one.
Okay. Similar, though, yeah, The New Languages.
Yeah.
The, so then Casey McLuhan would do conventional ponderings, and he'd say, he'd sort of look at what is evil under these conditions, or what is suicide? He occasionally take on, quote, a moral issue and think about it a little bit. Often he was tolerant of it. He said suicide was not a problem. You know, you ever seen that sentence?
No, I haven't. But,
it's in the 50s, in Renaissance, or those kind of articles. He said, we can see that suicide may be a viable option. That's because he saw 1984 happen in 1934, and the planet was gone, human dimension, by 1900. So you can see, you really see what McLuhan's pointing out, and you can't make a breakthrough, some kind of equanimity that comes from, quote, religion or something, or faith. If you can't do that, suicide is a natural option that he recognizes, that's a good way to, if it's all... It's not so wrong to commit suicide considering what we're doing to ourselves. You're just an early...
We are committing suicide.
Yeah, we are committing suicide. You're just doing an early version of it, you know, personally.
Yeah, yeah. a micro version of the macro.
Yeah.
Yeah, but and, notice how suicide is a living out of the need for media fast.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you ought to get a break. I need a break today.
Man, you're getting a real break.
Now, what's interesting is sleep is that. Sleep gives people a break from their media environment. And then they
hope. That's right. And so in Finnegan's Wake, you have the kind of awakening to the media environment that comes across as nightmare.
Yeah. No, it's so perfect the way he translates Finnegan's Wake. And when you talk to Joycians, they'll say, you can put any meaning into Finnegan's Wake. And they go on actually about the content, and they accept every crazy interpretation. But they don't see, there's a larger pattern maybe beyond interpretation that McLuhan saw that Joyce was getting to. Because Joyce said that he didn't want any particular angle or interpretation to rule. He was canceling the whole process of understanding.
Yeah. And look at Joyce. Writing in Finnegan's Wake in the 1930s, in terms of what we were just saying about the McLuhan family.
Yes.
So Joyce is sitting there. His daughter is going crazy. His wife is trying to deal with an environment where there's no money, where they're constantly moving, just as Joyce had constantly moved when he was a young boy with his family. Everything is a complete mess where Joyce can't find things. He can't read things because his eyes have gone so bad.
He's the worst guy to take on the new task. The worst guy.
But at the same time, he's got this peculiar equanimity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you have the same combination that you have in McLuhan of a completely crazy environment combined with, well, you know, that's sort of the way it is.
That's right. Now, I actually posted on the Finnegan's Wake group something exactly like that. Let's see if I can bring it up.
I notice they're both Irishmen.
Yeah. Well, Irish, Scottish? Joyce is pure. He's no Scottish in Joyce, is there? I don't think
no.
so. But no. McLuhan claimed he had Scottish in him.
Oh, definitely. Well, he was Northern Irish, Protestant Irish. So his family was from what is now still part of the kingdom over there, the UK.
Right. You know what that is? The cold fish of the British, or that part of the world. You know, they're in the north. It's cold. They're not warm southerners. Their coldness might have prepared them for that kind of equanimity in this global theater. You know what I mean? Their Irishness, you're saying, could be due to the peculiar weather and environment that they exist in, those cultures. Remember, McLuhan
says there's a humor. The thing about Ireland is that there's a humor about their situation.
Yeah.
They're a little bit like Canada. Ireland is so dominated by the English language and English laws and English armed forces and an English overclass that in order to sort of maintain their dignity, they had to locate that dignity on another level. And that other level was humor, taking an odd view of things.
Blacks in America, Canadians in the West, similar
yeah.
situation.
Correct.
Canadians being a colony, then a nation, then a colony again. So there's a, in responding to empire, the Irish had developed an interesting response. And McLuhan pointed out that Shaw and Oscar, what's the famous Oscar guy? I forget his last name.
Wilde?
Yeah, Oscar Wilde, Shaw, Joyce, and maybe a couple other Irish writers, Yeats, they took over the cultural scene in London. They took over the empire because
sure.
they had
That's
that
right.
Irish sensibility, which was mm-hmm. necessary for the new media environment.
Correct. Correct, but because of the need for fasting. You needed to be able to see it and to see its dominance, but to also have a gap from it. You needed to at once recognize your dire situation, but step back from it. And that's what they were able to do. And he brought that together with Eliot and Pound Stein with the idea that Americans, when they came to England and when they came to Europe, had that kind of distance that the Irish had. And so when Pound becomes the secretary to Yeats in the teens, then that brings together the Irish and the American can be seen in the whole interrelationship of Eliot, Pound, Yeats, and Joyce.
Yeah,
and of course, Lewis.
And Lewis there.
Lewis was born in America and had that kind of distance simply because he was such an odd character.
He was born in Canada, in Nova Scotia.
Yeah, that's
but,
right.
I would add the Irish were forced into a media fast because they weren't allowed to run their society. So they were forced to be observers on the sideline, like Canadians are in relation to America. So
yeah.
that's the characteristic, is they had a cultural media fast. They were kicked out of the action. They had to sit back in a media fast, imposed media fast situation.
Correct, correct. And that's why what McLuhan saw, and saw quite correctly, is that as the media became more invasive, the Anglo-Saxon culture would disintegrate, and the new stars would be colored people. They would be people that knew the dominance, but also knew that that wasn't them. And our whole society now is trying to come to grips with this sort of world historical fact.
Yes. What do they say that the 20th century is the greatest century for exiles, refugees? Everybody is kicked out of wherever they came from and put in nomadic purgatory, right?
Sure.
Everybody is a refugee. So,
The word nomad. The word nomad is very important for McLuhan, right? He brought together nomad and no man.
Yes, yeah. And no man allowed around here. Nobody's allowed to be mad here. No mad.
Yeah.
So in the Reading Finnegan's Wake forum, Facebook forum, I posted some stuff about the January 6th hearings. And a documentary that came out with a whole different bunch of footage that no one had seen before. You would have seen it on I and Bob, a new documentary. And so the entanglement of the Clintons with everything, and and Jeffrey Epstein and all this stuff. So I said, I posted that story, and I said, this is just like Finnegan's Wake. The entanglement of everybody. But I just said, this is Finney's Wake. So someone posted, and they said, I might have said a few other words. But anyway, so someone says, this sounds like QAnon stuff. If this is true, this is certainly not a group that I want to be part of. So this ridiculous moral response. And so the organizer of the Facebook said, okay, yikes. I'm shutting down this thread, so they wouldn't let me respond to him, and stopped it and removed it because it's too inflammatory. So I responded. I said this as a separate topic, starting a new thread. I said the first pattern to get a handle on. Say this again. The first pattern to get a handle on Finnegan's Wake is it, then hyphen this book in quotes book. / radio program, hyphen, is the tactile interplay of high culture and low culture, hyphen. You will be offended, ... no matter where you've mastered your cool in quotes. If you're not offended, then you haven't seen it all, ... yet. So you get what I'm saying? I'm pointing out this person was offended that some pattern that he thought was beneath the quality of discussion. And I think that it helped me see that Joyce made a book that will offend you ultimately. And McLuhan used to say that he'd love the Wake, but then it would drive him up the wall. So he took it so far, Joyce, that he made it, in the end, you most Finneganese people get to the point where, what the hell am I reading this for? This is so ridiculous. I can't get a point, can't get a conclusion, I don't know what story is. And that's actually how we live today. Can't get any answers to anything. Just think of all the stories you hear about that you don't hear the completion of. So this environment is a manipulative satire on all of us. And the Wake mimes that. He actually shows the process of life, living. You will be more offended than not. And you better figure out how to deal with that. And we'll bring in the media fest. How are you going to be cool about it? So I will repeat, the first pattern to get a handle on Finnegan's Wake is, first, you realize this book or radio program is the tactile interplay of high culture and low culture. you will be offended, no matter where you've mastered your cool. So we're talking about media fasting as a way of adopting Irish cool, but national cultures' presentation of coolness differently in different cultures is not enough for today. There's a new kind of irritation or language that requires a new kind of cool.
Absolutely.
Right. So if you're not offended, then you haven't understand me and Cameron at all yet. Okay, so another. So I posted that, and a few people liked that. But there was this woman who's a very good Joyce scholar on the literate level. She posted this. They're always questioning about the act of reading Finnegan's Wake, you know, in this group dynamic here. So she says, the key problem and delight of reading Finnegan's Wake, and we could think of McLuhan, the key problem and delight of reading Finnegan's Wake is that we don't know the nature of what we're reading. What kind of book? Is it a novel, an oracle, an encyclopedia, a riff on several holy books, a cartography, a musical score, just a bunch of misunderstandings, a mockery of how we think of language, guidelines for a resurrection, groundwork for infinite epiphanies, a dream journal, poop taxonomy, a history of the world, an atlas, a weather map? And then she says, if Ulysses takes a different structure for each section of the book, if Ulysses takes a different structure for each section, each chapter, here, Joyce, in Finnegan's Wake, the entire book is simultaneously all of these things, and most importantly, the relationship between all of these, or the playful movement between all of these, making a, quote, serious, unquote, reading impossible, because the book makes you continually shift positions and scratch your head and wonder what you are reading and what you are scratching. So I thought that was an interesting question, but...
Yeah, very interesting.
But it's still content, trying to classify it. And I think my quote was directed at her. I didn't say it. But I think what I'm saying is a larger situation. These are all content annoyances. But the process of annoyance that is Finnegan's Wake is what's really going on, not whether it's a poop taxonomy or infinite epiphanies or a weather map. Those are minor.
But remember, the woman is pointing out the plurality of these possibilities.
Yeah.
And so what she's saying is that we're situated in between these possibilities, and that can be... make us anxious, or it can make us laugh, or it can. There's all sorts of responses that we can have, but that, she's saying the first fact about Finnegan's Wake is that there's no answer to which of these is at stake, because they're all simultaneously at stake.
Yes.
So I see what she's saying as agreeing with you. You're talking about the necessary exile that is involved in taking offense. And she's talking about the situation of exile, namely that there's no ground rules that are sufficient to describe what's going on.
Yeah, and let's see. Okay, so here's the reaction to what she posted. So first guy says, it's a dream. A long one. And then she says, in response, Jim, you're a dream. Then she says, check it out, though. I'm suggesting, not just interpreting. Oh, I know what I wanted to say about her. Yeah, she's presenting a simultaneous thing similar to me, but they don't know the media angle, which gives you a larger span of time. And it swallows up way more categories. If you just talk about Gutenberg or Marconi, and that's what McLuhan said, the medium is the message is a useful approach to our situation because it covers a huge span of time, and we need that span of time because we have access to so much information about history and thousands of years. So we got way more information overload, so we need a bigger frame of generalization. So that's the problem, is that she's got a lot of good points. She's got simultaneity in her mind, but she's still stuck in content. They can't see the larger environment. So then she says, check it out, though. I'm suggesting, not just interpreting, but the relationship between interpretations. So I'm suggesting not just interpreting, but the relationship between interpretations. For example, Finnegan's wake is the man's funeral, but sounds like wake or waking up or the wake of a wave, making us think that a wave, when it recurs, is a kind of resurrection. That reading of wave is only possible by bouncing off the other readings. See, still bouncing off content. So someone says, waves wake up when they realize they are the ocean. Well, we're pointing out that the ocean is the new medium. Or, historically, there's been all kinds of oceans. And then she says, well, that's beautiful. Waves wake up when they realize they're the ocean. And then the guy who runs the thing, he says, well put. And then she says, this entire post is an apologia for your chosen name for this group. So she addressed the organizer. It's called Reading Finnegan's Wake. A very good name, because what are we reading and how to read together? And hearing others' readings is the entire point, me thinks. So then someone, Clint, responds. He goes, well, let me just check. Is that his first response?
Yeah, that's typical for Clinton.
If it's typical for what?
That's typical for how Clinton would start off.
Yeah, but it's not Clinton.
Oh, it's not. Oh,
No. This is not Clinton. This is the guy who runs the thing is Clinton. Hey, don't be in speakerphone mode unless you have to. You're feeding your dog or something. You're too blurry. Come back on the phone.
Okay, got it.
You see, that's a lot better. So she says, I like the title, Reading Finnegan's Wake, of the form. He says, I'm beginning to think there's no figuring the book out. Light bulb moment. There's no light bulb moment, no figuring out, or big payout. It's honestly soured me toward it for over a year now. So remember I was telling you that they eventually get fed up. And this is a guy who loves the book. He's been celebrating it for years on the form, but now he's admitting he's pissed off at it. He says, I haven't read it much, but I'm starting to see it as a book that meets you where you're at. You want to sing it? Great. You want to chant it? Great. You want to obsess over every reference and detail? Great. You want to hunt for the novelistic story? Great. It's all great and ever-changing. So she says, now she's probably finding, well, gee, you mean you actually don't like it? She says, what I'm enjoying in this group, she says, is really the multiple subgenres of reading that develop. Take, for example, all of the Christian denominations and how particular readings, interpretations, marginalia, and even ideas of what the Bible is in the first place determine so many distinct social forms. And we are free to take on particular understanding of particular moments, but the atmosphere changes and we slip into another realm, a cosmic comedy of perpetual movement without a single meaning. Now, I would say that the cosmic comedy of perpetual movement without a single meaning. Yeah, you could say that's the way life has always been. But under electric conditions of the 20th century, it was exaggerated, squared, quadrupled, right?
Sure, that's the global theater, right?
Yeah, to the point that people, interior landscape, to the point that it's a cliche for people to be recognized or living in a cosmic comedy of perpetual movement without a single meaning. Slower societies didn't have that. Didn't have that sensation. Maybe occasional alienated personality might have, but in general, you could develop a meaning or a myth and live in it. So then he says to that, a way to think of the book is it's like a very technical mountain with a near endless number of climbing routes. Climbing one route gives you a very specific experience and thrill, but it's not a complete conquering or understanding of the mountain. So she goes, yes. That's very funny, and I will add that we could climb as a professional climber or a worshiper or a mountain goat or with the intention to ski down, view the horizon, or as part of a portage route, etc. So then he says, and of course, you can climb the same route 100 times and get a different experience each time depending on the weather, gear, experience, hunger, emotional state, etc., etc., etc. And she says, yes, and weather is a good entryway because weather doesn't mean anything. Instead, remember McCool's Hot and Cool? Weather doesn't mean anything, mean capitalized. Instead, it is the basis of how we perceive, feel, or think. It is more fundamental than meaning. and orients our life, cultural festivals, waking, sleeping in a particular but always shifting way. So then this other guy comes in and says, see Finnegan's Wake as autistic narrative. And she says, again, this post is not about a specific reading, but how multiple readings relate to each other and constant shifts in reading. So it is never about autism or dreams, but about the way autism, with its repetitive patterns, would relate to music or dreaming or death or life or madness or politics or the impossibility of communication. I would say that's getting close to what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. No, she sounds like a very smart person.
Yeah. So this other guy comes in and he says, certainly, you know, the wake creates interesting commentary. So he says, in approaching the wake, I think you need a place to anchor. Once you decide that, which may take you a minute or 100 years, you start delving down, soaring up, and reticulating outward from that anchoring point. I chose Phoenix Culprit, it's in quotes, Phoenix Culprit, as my anchoring point. I am still lost, but in a seemingly more meaningful way. Okay, so then she says, fair enough, I agree. As long as you agree that sometimes the anchor is lifted, sometimes there is a lifeboat, sometimes a larger vessel, sometimes scuba diving, and the anchor is temporary but essential, anything to keep from drowning. So he says, Rick says, okay, now I realize I'm a lot more lost than I thought after listening to her, but that's why it's such an adventure. And then she says, I like the word disaster, apparently coming from disaster, as in not being able to see stars, meaning no signs of orientation when on a ship. That is a disaster. And then he says, no, someone else.
How that relates to what I was saying about consider.
Yes, sidereal, right. Mm-hmm. And then a third guy comes in. He says, you're not lost. You're just at sea. So then Rick says, just turn back and look at my anchor when it gets too dark and I need some reassurance. So then she says, I like Joseph Conrad's line, the fog is more blinding than the night because lights don't work. Try lights and you get opaque whiteness back. So then I come in and I go, an anthropologist, a fellow First Nations explorers in the forested deeps of Canada, we're lost. His friends, meaning the Native Indians, his friends' response, we're not lost, wigwam lost. you know, we got that from McLuhan, right? You've heard that anecdote?
Yeah.
They never thought they were lost. They were in acoustic space. The wigwam was lost. So then somebody, I guess, has had enough. So they go scratch, burp, fart, gurgle, 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 scratch, soma, or. All right? So they get into phatic sounds. So then I go, okay, here's something they don't know. I've posted different McLuhan quotes, but this one I don't think I ever posted anywhere, so I finally transcribed it. So on page 102 of Take Today, he says, James Joyce knew that any word was a storehouse of innumerable human perceptions that could be released by abrasive interplay with other words. Given any two words, McLuhan said, Joyce could invent a verbal universe. The following fugue or dance of tones and gestures, if read aloud, provides a dramatic account of organized ignorance. So he's going to do that famous quote on page 18 of Finnegan's Wake. But below it, I say, you might not read it before you read the Joyce quote, but I say, McLuhan often explained what he's doing as, quote, organizing ignorance for discovery, unquote. Or he called the activity applied Joyce. So you can have that and then understand why McLuhan says this quote is a dramatic account of organized ignorance. So the quote is, in the ignorance that implies the impression that knits knowledge, that finds the name form, that whets the wits, that convey contacts, that sweetened sensation that drives desire, that adheres to attachment, that dogs death, that bitches birth, that entails the ensuance of existentiality.
Mm-hmm.
So
all of human life from the beginning of history to the end
is in that quote.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one person liked my quote, Gary Hunter, my McLuhan quote. My earlier statement about, did I read the very first thing I put out? Yeah, what was my first quote? I got a lot. Oh yeah, the pattern. The book was always there to offend you. Will always offend you. That got a lot of likes. People like that one. So I think this is a nice digression. We're talking about McLuhan when talking about Finnegan's Wake. So we covered with these other people's quotes our eternal issues. Well, eternal up to a point, maybe. We may come to a resolution.
Well, eternal is what comes into question as soon as you have the media fast.
Right.
Because the media fast is a break from the narrative. So the ascetic moment, as McLuhan called it, is a kind of well or a maelstrom into which media fast is precipitated.
Yeah, it's kind of a death.
Absolutely. It's a death, and it's a death in every sense, a death of orientation, a death of framework. It's something that calls for a new orientation that is built on the debris of the old orientations. So that's why the maelstrom was so important to McLuhan, is that the escape can only be made by studying the pattern of the whirlpool and then riding the detritus of the previous wrecks. Right? So that's how we read Pound, for example. That's how we read Joyce and Eliot as attempting to ride the remaining fragments of the destruction of our previous orientations.
Yeah, and so McLuhan said that Edgar Allan Poe was on the level of a Leonardo da Vinci with his breakthrough, mm-hmm. because his statement of looking at the effects preceding causes or the maelstrom is a first attempt to express a detachment, a coolness toward Gutenberg content. And,
yeah.
You know, bringing in the multifarious whirlpools and different environments you'd experience that way. So that's why, you know, he affected the symbolists, Baudelaire and those guys. And then the later Men of 1914, Poe was very important. So McLuhan was lucky to stumble in. Do you know how he discovered Poe? Do you know, was it at Cambridge or when he was young? Do you know anything about that?
I actually have raised that question in the post, in several posts on the blog. He was already talking about Poe in the early 1940s. And it may be that Clint Brooks was influential in this because Brooks was an expert in the New Criticism, but he was also an expert in Southern culture,
yeah.
and American literature. And Poe was regarded as a Southerner and part of the Southern literary tradition.
Yes.
So it may be that in that context, he began to talk about Poe.
Right. So that Brooks is one of the first guys to take Poe seriously?
Well, I don't know. That's certainly not true. I mean, Baudelaire took
yeah.
Poe very seriously, right? So it's also possible that McLuhan, through his study of the French, that he got precipitated into through Eliot, through Pound, and through Gideon. It may be that he sort of got rebounded back from Baudelaire to Poe.
Yeah, and but I guess I should say that the Clint is the first American to take Poe seriously. Up to that point, he's a Jerry Lewis, you know, the comedian, Jerry Lee Lewis or Jerry Lewis. One's a singer, mm-hmm. one's a comedian. Jerry Lewis.
Right.
You know how the French celebrated in the 50s, those guys that became the Nouvelle Director, the new wave of directors. I forget what
mm-hmm.
that Village Voice, Andrew Saras called it, the auteur theory, A-U-T-E-U-R. You know,
right.
The auteur, the director was the guy who made the movie. It was the ground of it. They, in the 50s, celebrated Jerry Lewis, his movies, his corny comedy, because they thought it was a documentary of American life.
Mm-hmm.
So
they saw a remove. They saw Lewis as taking a conscious remove from his environment that Americans didn't see.
Yeah.
Americans saw Lewis within the environment as being funny. It's a little bit like Homer Simpson.
Yeah.
Homer Simpson can be taken as your neighbor, but he can also be seen as a meta critique of the culture.
Yeah.
And the French were inclined to take the meta critique point of view.
Right. And so Clarence Brooks might have been the first American to take the South. I mean, those guys took the South seriously. That was their revolution. And the North had been snobbish about the South. So maybe he was the first within American culture to take the Jerry Lewis of the 19th century. Edgar Allan Poe just did monster movies or monster stories or horror stories and make a meta level out of him. So I'll limit it to America that Brooks was the first to see of Poe. I mean, I don't know if anybody appreciated. And he was considered quite a scoundrel in many ways and, you know, died ignominiously. And all kinds of crazy stuff about him.
And
he would not, probably too much of a journalist kind of person. But I'm not.
Well, a journalist, an alcoholic, a madman.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, an unhappy lover, on and on and on.
Yeah. Okay, so back to my book, page 99, we're talking about the virtual economy, and McLuhan is going to say, there's nothing at all difficult about putting computers in the position where they will be able to conduct carefully orchestrated programming of the sensory life of whole populations. I know it sounds rather science fictional, but if you understood cybernetics, you'd realize we could do it today. Now, he says it sounds rather science fictional. Remember, he said Mechanical Bride was a new kind of science fiction. So it could be a self-referential thing there.
Right. But notice how what he's doing there is he's putting on the mask of his father. He's saying all this may sound crazy, but you can look on it with humor and equanimity. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
Right?
The computer could program the media to determine the given messages that people should hear in terms of their overall needs, creating a total media experience absorbed and patterned by all the senses. We could program 5 hours less of TV in Italy to promote the reading of newspapers during an election, or lay on an additional 25 hours of TV in Venezuela to cool down the tribal temperature raised by radio the preceding month. By such orchestrated interplay of all media, now there's your global theater, orchestrated interplay, whole cultures, your interior landscape, whole cultures can now be programmed in order to improve and stabilize their emotional climate. There's your weather metaphor. Just as we are beginning to learn how to maintain equilibrium among the world's competing economies. So Playboy says, how does such environmental programming, however enlightened in intent, differ from Pavlovian brainwashing? McLuhan says, like his father, your question reflects the usual panic of people confronted with unexplored technologies. I'm not saying such panic isn't justified or that such environmental programming couldn't be brainwashing or far worse, merely that such reactions are useless and distracting. Though I think the programming of societies could actually be conducted quite constructively and humanistically, I don't want to be in the position of a Hiroshima physicist extolling the potential of nuclear energy in the first days of August 1945. But an an understanding of media's effects constitutes a civil defense against media fallout. The alarm of so many people, however, at the prospect of corporate programming's creation of a complete service environment on this planet is rather like fearing that a municipal lighting system will deprive the individual of the right to adjust each light to his own favorite level of intensity. Computer technology can and doubtless will program entire environments to fulfill. He's just going to do it anyways. Computer technology can and doubtless will program entire environments to fulfill the social needs and necessary preferences of communities and nations. that's all Gutenbergian preference. The content, and it has this in italics, the content of that programming, however, depends on the nature of future societies. But that is in our own hands. I like the way he, see, content becomes that sentence in Take Today on page 11, where the figure and the ground merge. The content becomes the ground. The word that makes the market at the White House is, or the narrative. Who gets to say the narrative is the new ground. Once we've imploded into a global theater and the planet's an art form, and we've ended the technological evolution, then it's a battle over the medium, but the medium is the content. Who gets to say what's what?
Right. Notice the word hands is referring to tactility there.
Oh, yeah.
And when he says computer technology can and doubtless will program entire environments, that's already happened. He's predicting the future by looking at the present.
And defining what was happening in new terms. Because the people doing it are working with new technology. They're nervous about it. They don't want too much attention on what they're doing because they're not sure what they're doing.
Exactly. They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So, and that, but that's the human folly that you're going about with great dedication, doing stuff that you don't understand.
Yeah.
Don't understand what it's doing to you. Don't understand what it's doing to your family. Don't understand what it's doing to your country. Don't understand what it's doing to anything.
That's why every Christian in medieval times should have been forced to go to a monastery to have a media fast, no matter how stupid they were, smart or educated. A media fast helps them. And now you see that in the popular sensibility, is all these people carrying around yoga mats. Yoga is a way to get a temporary media fast in an impossible situation. So people do this, you know, 15 minutes here or there, they'll do a little yoga fast.
Yeah, yeah. So even today, people go on retreats.
Yeah.
Right? And that's exactly what a media fast is. It is to step back, to retreat, to step back from your environment and question it, and try to reorient yourself. And what McLuhan's basic advice is, retreat, try to consider where you are, and above all, ask, what are these media that are so powerful in our environment? So the media is the message. We have to consider what those media are and how they act. That's the whole point of his life, really, was to raise those questions.
Right. So the meaning of repent is to retrace your life. So you go into retreat. Now, something that's very popular, you have those yoga retreats or New Age retreats, but you also have a lot of people maybe go to night school or go to classes, or they like workshops. They'll go to a conference and, you know, 3 days listening to literate lectures. That's adopting the old Gutenberg position as an art form to get away from the electric maelstrom or digital maelstrom. They'll go back to the classroom. That's another form of media fast. So
correct.
People,
and notice,
go ahead.
McLuhan didn't say that you could be exclusively in a literate environment. He believed, like, let's say, Freud, that there's always multiple levels going on. So if somebody goes to a conference and it's about letters and the conference has a very literal organization, top-down, all that sort of stuff, that seems to be purely Gutenbergian. But at the same time, it's a retreat, and at the same time, there's conversations going on at the edge of the conference, and at the same time, there's people's unconscious is working away inside them. And so there is a very complex environment going on there, and the meaning of that environment is simply to raise the question of where it's at. And, of course, as you know, McLuhan was constantly just saying we need to consider where it's at. What does that mean? What does that phrase mean? What does it implicate?
Yeah, so he said the new media, the new yoga is self-entertainment.
Yeah.
To control your involvement. So now there's an example of a natural ecology. People spend a lot of time, from the baby boomers on, going to conferences for the last 50 years. That was a retrieval of the Gutenberg environment for another purpose, a media fast. And that was a natural balancing to the storm that came in with Nixon and everybody, whatever president you want to name, that society developed. I mean, people didn't go to classes like that before World War II. You know what I mean? It would be a small literary group like Bloomsbury that might have those kind of environments, but for the theosophists. But for whole populations to be going to some form of workshop in whatever area they're interested in or their profession demands. Remember, that was another thing. Conferences took over in the jet age, McLuhan said, for people to have a media fast. He didn't say that part. But just think of all the conferences that every profession has every year. It's a way of getting in touch with your particular environment that you work in, your mythic stage. Uh-oh, you disconnected?
No, I'm right here.
Okay.
Go ahead. I don't know what that was.
Yeah. So what did I just say there? Well, give me a word or two you heard.
And what we were just talking about?
Yeah. Or? What were some last words I just said?
You were talking about conferences.
Yeah, conferences. And in every profession, there are conferences, right?
And yeah, absolutely.
They certainly didn't do that, as far as I know, in the 20s and 30s, 100 years ago. That would be very rare. Somebody might go to one conference in their lifetime somewheres. I'm pointing out how naturally humans create an ecology. So we're still crashing into Armageddon, but we got this far because of all those compensatory uses of older media in new situations to counter the horrible present, the stressful present. Super stressful. You get me? See what I'm saying?
Yeah. But conference, in a way, recapitulates all of human life and also raises the question of what that life is. So I'm just looking up the etymology. And so the pharynx is the same word family that we have in ferry, for example, the boat ferry. It's related to carry something across, to bear, right? So a conference is a group that raises the question of the burden of human beings. What do we bear with us? So we bear children, we bear meaning, we bear our obligations, we bear the burden of the whole question of what it means to be finite, what it means to be born and to die. So a conference is something that it's a surface manifestation that gives way to deeper levels of questions. It's a surface manifestation that happens in all human life where something obvious is taking place at the surface, but beneath the surface, there are all sorts of questions and doubts and problems are bubbling away.
Yeah, the word you're looking for is metaphor. Remember, that means to carry across.
Yes. Yes.
So environments become metaphors.
Correct. So this all relates back to what we were saying in Finnegan's Wake, because there is no word, there is no human activity that does not have these multiple levels to it. So we are always questioning what it means to be a human being, what it means to exist in a human society, what it means to exist in a sidereal environment. We are always doing that, but we don't know that we're doing it. So what McLuhan is saying, along with all sorts of people in the tradition, is step back from what you're doing in order to see what you're doing.
Yeah. So we'll have to wrap it up. You got to go. So I'm just going to read my oral translation of that Playboy quote that I read. So I say,
okay.
Beg your pardon?
Let me just go to your book here for a second so I can follow it closely.
Yeah,
okay,
page 100, I think it is.
Yeah, it is page 100, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you have the, but that is in our own hands, McLuhan says at the end of the quote in Playboy. And I say, translating it, people have this massive lighting system going on in their homes, in the streets, and they don't think of programming it and adjusting it to their individual preferences. And McLuhan says, that's what we're doing. He says, quote, I'm laying out environments that you're not going to worry about whether you're free to adjust it or not. You might find the environment a great service environment, like electric light is, municipal lighting system, unquote. It's important to get that point. We're not demanding freedom in relation to these new environments. We are accepting them. And as we get more and more post-literate, we accept them even more so.
Right. But when we accept them, we understand them in new ways. So, for example, we now understand that a municipal lighting system isn't just a fabulous boon like people thought 100 and 150 years ago. We now understand that it's a kind of light pollution that obscures our access to the stars and thereby obscures our access to all of the societies for whom stars were so important. So we need to have a media fast from a lighting system in order to have new access to the dark that was always so important to human society, but we've lost touch with it.
I didn't know it, but I solved that problem after being in New York for 15 years. So we moved here. We're on the side of a mountain. It's like the second tallest mountain in the world.
In the world or in Hawaii?
In the world.
You mean, but that's because you're thinking of it from the base of the ocean.
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. So two-thirds is underwater, and there's 10,000 feet, but it's a 30,000 mountain, and there's a sign at the top where there's a military station that says this is 500 feet taller than Mount Everest. And then the one over in the other island is a little taller than ours, so we're number two. But what I wanted to say is that we have a very dark environment in the evening because the military runs this area sort of secretly, and they need their space stuff, you know, not bothered, all their telescopes and that, so they don't want any lighting from the people coming up the side of the mountain. So we have a very dark situation here. In other words, very unusual. Most suburbs don't have that, but we have it. So I walked right into a necessary fast from city lighting that you were just spelling out that we need. That's what I got here.
Yeah.
It's very dark here in the evenings at night. Mm-hmm. But that's because the military says, you peasants, we want the stars. We're not going along with this 20th century technology. Screw your multiple lighting systems. You
right,
don't
right.
get one here. You got the beach and sun and good weather, but you can't have everything. No, you're going to have stars whether you want them or not. Okay.
Correct. So that's my translation. When you talk about turning off the radio or newspapers in Venezuela, for example, my translation of that into a practical recommendation would be, in Canada, every city, town, and village should have one day a month where lighting is not allowed.
Mm.
And what would happen through that is that there would be new access to the Milky Way and to the stars, and it would raise the question of where are we? What should we be doing? What is our orientation? And so it would be a kind of media fast from lighting that would raise questions, and through those questions, we would have a possible solution. The media fast itself would not be the solution, but the question of orientation would be the first step towards a solution.
Yeah. It's interesting that the society can't have an organized fasting like you suggest. At least that one hasn't come across. But the society has festivals and all kinds of activities that people use to get the retreat from the ongoing basic desperation of daily life, the panic, and whatever it is, the anxiety that doesn't allow anybody to get the society together to organize the sensible thing that you're suggesting. You know, it's interesting how you can't get that. But people do get it through other media, like for, it used to be the church, and maybe still is, but that's the natural ecology. So McLuhan recommended, you know, programming Venezuela, but the people said, no, we're going to go to classrooms. We're going to go to workshops instead of having it turned off. That's their media ecology that they compensate it with.
But that is a turning off. So
yeah.
it's a deliteralization of turning off. So instead of turning a knob to turn off or on a media device, going to a conference or going to a yoga session or going to a retreat, that is a kind of deliteralization of what turning off means. It's a release from this hectic environment that is needed for humans to begin to breathe in a new way.
Well said. So then I said
you were at the point of computer technology you were going to read. Yeah.
So McLuhan says, you might find the environment a great service environment, like electric light is, municipal lighting systems. And then I say, it's important to get that point. Then I quote McLuhan, computer technology can and doubtless will program entire environments to fulfill the social needs and sensory preferences of communities and nations. Then I say, nowadays, over the last 5 years, that would be 2015 to 2020, I guess. Nowadays, over the last 5 years, in the Web 2.0 phase, people would say, quote, yeah, that's happening now. And then I say, it's called surveillance capitalism, with all the devices that people allow themselves to be programmed with. They can't stop it. 50 years later, they think McLuhan's vision has arrived now. But no, it was actually back then, and it's something perhaps worse now. So, yeah, surveillance capitalism is a kind of media ecology, the monitoring of people's, that Facebook and that do, of everybody's
right.
activity.
So he saw that in the 1940s.
Yeah.
So his friend Muller Thiem was talking about how corporations need to know the tastes and the preferences of their consumers in order to make the products that fit with that consumer preference. And so surveillance capitalism was already obvious in the 1940s. And McLuhan then interpreted ads as functioning within that environment.
Yeah. And he was blessed by meeting people like Muller Thiem. He was lucky that
Absolutely.
Way.
That's right.
So I end by saying the word content is italicized in the actual Playboy interview. And I noticed that years later, no one else has ever pointed that out. I asked, question, why is content italicized? That means the form and the message came together. Content was now the medium. The content of that programming is up to us. No, that's a question. The content of that programming is up to us?
Question mark, yeah.
Yeah. Well stated, Bob. So that brings us to 101. And another, just looking at it, he says in the middle of the next quote, I write cartoons. So we're going to handle that shift by McLuhan next time.
Good.
So very good discussion, and fun bringing in Finning His Wake people as they wrestle.
Absolutely.
Wrestle with the book without McLuhan's help, unless they read my post. Okay. Thanks a lot, Cameron. We'll talk soon.
Okay, Bob. Yep, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.